as a domestic policy issue, just as much as a foreign policy issue. It is affecting what is going to happen in the upcoming election. I think people are really dissatisfied with the response of the administration. I think that we're seeing that in the church a couple days ago with the protests. We're seeing it with protests across the country. We're seeing city council members and local legislators and policymakers take stances to support an immediate ceasefire. That disconnect from the people is really concerning for American democracy, but it's concerning because it feels like digging into the current position means that it's not as valuable to listen to the people and that our policymakers are going to make the decisions that they're going to make. And I think when we see an administration circumvent Congress by issuing hundreds of millions of dollars of weapons to a foreign government and circumventing the processes that are in place, ignoring really important laws to protect both Americans, but also abide by international humanitarian law, I think there are significant implications for what that means for America more broadly.
Tarek, I wanted to ask you, in your work at the Education Department, you were focused particularly on higher education. I'm wondering, what's your response to what's been happening on so many campuses across the country and the politicians in, or some politicians in Congress trying to support and build up the retaliation and targeting campaign faced by Palestinian rights advocates at the university campuses?
I'm so glad you asked that question. I feel like, so I already mentioned a little bit how like Americans don't feel like this is just an issue away from home. This is also a domestic policy issue. I think that is extremely clear on college campuses that have for decades been the grounds for public dissent, for protests, for being able to have a free exchange of ideas and communicate on issues that are really difficult. I think American higher education is meant to be a place to allow free speech in all of its forms. I think that's really important. I think the Department of Education recognizes that. But I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I think it's very clear the overcorrection that we've seen by institutions of higher education and their response to the weaponization of language in particular on college campuses and by political officials and right-wing extremists. I think at the end of the day, we need to ensure that students are safe, but we need to provide safe learning environments that do not infringe on their rights to be able to have those difficult conversations, to learn about issues that matter in the world right now. And this particular conflict is the forefront of those conversations in so many ways. I think when we see students on college campuses show solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, when we see students on college campuses condemn the daily atrocities that we see that are starving millions of Palestinians and decades of oppression and occupation that have led to unequal rights for Palestinians, I think that it's really important that we separate that from actual hate speech that is real and dangerous and growing across the country. And I think that we've seen politicians rely on the weaponization of language in order to minimize students' ability to organize and to speak about some really difficult issues. And we've seen that really affect the independence and the integrity of American higher education, and the risks to academic freedom are very real, and that is a responsibility for the Department of Education. And I think that was one reason for me why it took so long to really take this position, because I did feel an obligation on the issues that I work directly on to be able to help move the ball forward and provide as much support as possible to students across the country.
I'm wondering, you were still there, Tariq, at the Department of Education when the three Palestinian students were shot in Burlington, one from Trinity, one from Haverford, and one from Brown, Hisham Awatani, who is paralyzed from the chest down. And I was wondering your response there and within the department, and also, if you feel you face a different future than someone like Josh Paul, longtime State Department official who quit over Biden administration policy, you are a Biden appointee. But if you face something different as a Palestinian American.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to quickly touch on what happened in Vermont, which is absolutely horrific, I think part of the problem is the constant dehumanization of Palestinians and what we've seen both in the language that the White House has used and in what we have seen in terms of coverage here across the United States in the media, making it seem like Palestinians and in particular Palestinian men are less deserving of support, of humanity, of emotion. That allows people to feel like attacking them is acceptable, and that's a horrifying thing to realize, is that as a Palestinian, as a Palestinian man, as a Palestinian Christian, so many aspects of my own identity are erased on a daily basis, and it's truly horrifying that we allow that type of dehumanization to exist in our country today. For me, it's very personal, and yeah.
And talk about your background, Tariq, your family's background, your history.
Yeah, you know, I'm an American. I was born and raised here in the United States. But I descend from generations of Palestinians. I am a Palestinian-American. Like I said, I'm a Palestinian Christian. My family has been Christians for as far back as we know. And in 1948, my grandparents and many of my aunts and uncles who were alive at the time were forcibly displaced from their homes in Yaffa. And for those who don't know, it's on the water. Essentially where Tel Aviv is today, and they had to leave everything. They left their homes, they left their businesses, they left their friends. They saw a huge migration, a forced migration of their peers and massive levels of death. And for them, it was about self-preservation, about preserving future generations of their family, and they walked for miles to find somewhere safe. And I think it was happenstance that, you know, someone told them, oh, we think it's safe toward the east. Let's walk that direction. And as a Palestinian living in America, as a Palestinian living in the broader diaspora, not being able to return, there's a level of guilt that you have knowing that a decision that was made 75 years ago to walk east instead of south toward Gaza changed the entire trajectory of your life, changed the trajectory of your family's lives, because, you know, my family has been here in the States for a long time. But I could have very easily been in Gaza. My family could have been in Gaza. It's extremely emotional, and you feel guilty because you are safe and you can't do enough to protect lives that are being taken indiscriminately.
What are your plans now, Tariq?
I don't know. You know, I think this is such an important issue. I'm doing everything I can just to use whatever channels that I have to communicate about how important it is to end the violence immediately, to preserve as many lives as possible. I think we've heard the White House and the Secretary of State talk repeatedly about minimizing civilian casualties. We can do a lot better than minimizing them. We can end civilian casualties. in Gaza and in the West Bank. I think it's up to us to make that decision, to do a little bit of introspection on our own policies and positions, and recognize that it's been over 3 months. The military route has been an epic failure, and the only path to peace, as the Secretary of State talked about just yesterday, is a diplomatic one. And when we talk about providing humanitarian aid and increasing the level of aid that's getting to people in Gaza who are starving, it's really hard to do that if there is continuous bombing of all of the safe regions. There's nowhere safe left. There hasn't been anywhere safe left for weeks and weeks. It's really important that you end the violence so that you can provide the level of support that's needed if we want to seriously contemplate a future for Palestinians.
Tariq Abbas, I want to thank you for being with us. Former Biden administration political appointee who resigned last week from the Department of Education in response to President Biden's support of Israel's war in Gaza. He was the department's only Palestinian-American appointee. He was the first Biden appointee to quit. Coming up, is Israel using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza? We'll speak with an Israeli human rights group. Stay with us. Not Words by the legendary jazz drummer, composer, and activist Max Roach. Today would have been his 100th birthday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Several United Nations agencies, including the World Food Program, say Israel's bombardment of Gaza could lead to a famine throughout the entire Gaza Strip within 6 months unless immediate action is taken. Hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians are now in Rafah, and many are waiting in line for hours for small amounts of food as aid agencies struggle to meet the demand.
I came here to get food. I've been here since 9 a.m. just to get a plateful of food because the situation is very difficult. We are from Gaza City and we came to Rafah. The people of Rafah received us and welcomed us, but the numbers are large and the situation is very difficult. There is no money to buy food and there is no flour. We have no money to buy anything at home. There is no gas or anything that would help us to cook even a plate of lentils. We come here to get this plate of food, and it is not enough.
This comes as hundreds of trucks trying to bring aid to Gaza are backed up for miles in Egypt at the Rafah border crossing and have been forced to wait for weeks to enter. On Tuesday, British Foreign Secretary David Cameron urged Israel to lift barriers on delivering humanitarian aid into Gaza, citing, quote, real widespread hunger. Cameron was cross-examined by the Scottish MP Brendan O'Hara.
2 or 3 minutes ago, in answer a reply to the chair, you said, and I quote, one of the things we'd like the Israelis to do is switch the water back on. Now, that says that they turned it off. It says that you recognise they have the power to turn it on. Therefore, isn't turning water off and having the ability to turn it back on but choosing not to, isn't that a breach of international humanitarian law?
It's just something they ought to do, in my opinion.
No, of course they should do it. Every human being would say you don't cut people's water supply off. But I'm asking you, in your position as Foreign Secretary, point of international humanitarian law, if Israel have the power to turn the water back on that they turned off, surely that is a flagrant breach of international humanitarian law.
Well, I'm not a lawyer. My view is they ought to switch it on because the north of Gaza, the conflict is now effectively over there, and so getting more water and power into northern Gaza would be a very good thing to do. You don't have to be a lawyer to make a judgment about that. You just have to be a human being.
Last month, the UN Security Council passed a resolution to immediately increase aid deliveries in Gaza, and Human Rights Watch accused Israel of using starvation as a method of warfare, which violates international humanitarian law. Well, for more, we're going to Tel Aviv. We're joined by Sarit Mikhaeli, International Advocacy Lead for the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which has just published a new report, Israel is Starving Gaza, that says starvation is, quote, not a byproduct of war, but a direct result of Israel's declared policy. Sarit, welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out exactly what you found and what you feel can be done about it.
Well, in very basic terms, almost everyone in Gaza is hungry almost all of the time. 2.3 million people are surviving mostly on sometimes one meal a day, people skipping meals in order to feed their children, people busy constantly looking for the next meal, for the next source of food for them and their families and children. And all of this is happening in a place that is pretty much an hour's drive from here, right, where it's a supplying humanitarian assistance and food and all the necessities like water and other things that people rely on should not be a difficult problem. We're not talking about some sort of remote region internationally. We're talking about an area that is accessible, where the things that impede this provision of food for people who are starving is a declared policy by Israel. The fact that Israel isn't allowing enough trucks in, the fact that Israel isn't providing the ability, the logistical infrastructure to actually drive this food into Gaza in through places where it's possible to do, and many other decisions taken by the Israeli government that are impacting this, that are making it making the amount of assistance that is coming into Gaza simply a fraction of what the population need. And Amy, you quoted the international experts on this issue. Within a month, they expect almost all of the residents of the Gaza Strip to be up to what is phase three of this scale of horror, of hunger. And this is simply unacceptable when it's very clearly preventable. And the things that were said in the British Parliament by Minister Cameron are very clearly a clarification that this is the result of Israeli policies and actions. This is not just some sort of coincidence or just some unfortunate byproduct of war.
Well, Sarit, I wanted to ask you, how is Israel controlling the food supply, especially in Rafah, where Rafah leads into Egypt? So how exactly does it manage to continue to prevent trucks from getting in?
So Juan, let's even look at the past situation. I mean, Gaza was on the brink of collapse even before this war began with the horrific October 7th attack by Hamas against Israelis, right? So this has been a situation of food insecurity since the beginning of the Israeli blockade on Gaza, almost 17 years ago. But the Israeli decisions to cut off electricity, to cut off the water supply that Israel sells Gaza, to not allow all of the movement of the international humanitarian provision of supplies, those decisions made it almost impossible from the start for even bakeries to operate and provide for the people. And now what so the collapse was very quick and based on a very long period of deprivation. But now the issue really is that there needs to be hundreds of trucks entering Gaza every day, and just a fraction of that is entering. This is happening because Gaza, the Rafah crossing is just not equipped for the movement of goods. Goods should be entering Gaza through other border crossings that are generally with Israel, not with Egypt. Israel is also prohibiting the provision of food purchased on the Israeli market, so the aid agencies have to bring it from Egypt, which is even more difficult. Plus, there are also many restrictions on the ability to distribute it once it actually gets in to the Gaza Strip. And then we see these awful images of desperate people charging these provision convoys that are coming in and taking what they can because they are simply so desperate and the food isn't reaching some areas of Gaza. So you have a situation where in some areas of Gaza, things are only just bad, whereas in others, things are just absolutely atrocious. And this is not a very large area. So certainly, and I think it's recognized now by the international community, the Israeli government is at fault, is responsible for this. And this should lead to immediate international action, not simply conversations with Israeli policymakers, but actually clear clarifications that Israel is violating both its legal obligations, i.e., this is a war crime, and also that this is simply an immoral way to treat a civilian population.
After a visit to the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Gaza, U.S. Democratic Senators Jeff Merkley and Chris Van Hollen blasted the Israeli process for screening the aid. Senator Van Hollen spoke to CBS Face the Nation. This is what he said.
Many items that should be allowed to go into Gaza, water sort of filtration systems, other systems like that, were in a warehouse of rejected items that we visited. While we were there, we saw a truck turned away that had a big box from UNICEF, which is, of course, the UN organization that helps children. It was a unit to help with water desalinization. It was rejected. And when one item on a truck is rejected, the entire truck is rejected. The other big issue is within Gaza, the so-called deconfliction process, which is just a fancy name for those who are providing humanitarian assistance to have the confidence that they can deliver it without being killed.
If you can talk more about this, Sarit. Again, the Senator Van Hollen is the one who has also called for release of more information about the Israeli sniper who murdered Shireen Abu Akleh on May 11th, 2022, in Jenin, in the occupied West Bank.
Yeah, absolutely, Amy. Well, we certainly appreciate the leadership that Senator Van Hollen and actually Senator Merkley are showing on this issue. And it is absolutely crucial that U.S. lawmakers, both from the more progressive part of the Democratic Party, but also from the mainstream security-oriented, kind of more established part of the Democratic Party, are engaging with President Biden to demand action on this issue. Simply an unconscionable situation that is unfolding in front of us. Now, I'd like to refer to the second part of Senator Holland's discussion of the dangers inside of Gaza. Yes, absolutely. There's been another update by the office, the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, discussing an additional rejection by the Israeli authorities of another attempt to coordinate the transfer of medical goods into hospitals in the northern Gaza Strip. This was only the day before yesterday, apparently. So we're seeing that there are simply so many difficulties in trying to bring the aid, deliver the aid with safety for the aid providers, obviously, in this area that is bombed. And this brings us to the essential issue, which is that there needs to be a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. There needs to be a halt to Israeli airstrikes and bombardments in order for this food and aid and assistance, and not only food, medical supplies and other necessities have to be provided. And this is one, the continuation of the hostilities is making this provision far too dangerous and impossible currently. This is one other reason why we need this to stop. B'Tselem has called for a ceasefire. But, of course, the most important reason for this to stop is to stop the killing of civilians, of women and children and human beings in the Gaza Strip in a way that absolutely is disproportionate to what is facing Israel right now. And to the policies of, you know, basically airstrikes, bombing residential homes, all of this is one, you know, is and the huge death toll 23,000 Gazans and counting as a result, you know, that can only be described as a revenge attack after the horrific death toll that Israelis have suffered. But, you know, we simply cannot accept, you know, that not, it's certainly not moral and it's certainly not legal that we inflict such a degree of suffering on Gazans, we Israelis, regardless of how much we have suffered and how horrific we have been affected by this. There is simply no justification for the continuation of this Israeli attack on Gaza, and it has to stop. There has to be a ceasefire.
Sarit, I wanted to ask you, you're talking to us from Tel Aviv. How aware are Israelis of the catastrophic situation so close to where most of them live? And is there any significant portion of the population that cares?
Well, unfortunately, Juan, the situation is very, very depressing and just painful when we look at the responses of many Israelis, possibly even the majority of Israelis, to what we see now in Gaza. I think the majority of Israelis still support what we are doing there. There is very little protest or very little rejection of the methods that Israel is employing in its attack against the civilian population of Gaza. The Israeli media doesn't really broadcast much information about the suffering of Gazans, the devastation, the utter devastation of infrastructure, and the loss of homes, and the human beings who are being killed on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. But one of the saddest aspects of this is that even when people are aware of it, there are so many politicians and influencers and people who are simply rejecting any need to respect the humanity of people in Gaza. And unfortunately, some of the people who are aware of the huge price, the horrific toll that Gazans are paying, are not, you know, are simply okay with it. And this is one of the most depressing aspects of what is going on now in terms of the, you know, total dehumanization of Gazans in among many people in Israel. There are, I should mention, there are Israelis who are opposed to this situation. There are Israelis who are calling to recognize the humanity of Gazans, but we are in the minority, unfortunately.
Yeah, we have less than a minute left, but I wanted to ask you quickly. You've also been monitoring the violence in the West Bank that has gotten far less attention. Could you talk about what you've chronicled?
Absolutely, yes. So since October 7th, there's also been a massive increase in the violence by Israeli soldiers and also security forces and Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank. It has led to a really large number of Palestinians killed by soldiers and by Israeli settlers. It has led to takeovers of land by settlers, to the removal, to the forcible transfer of Palestinian herding communities from very large parts of the West Bank. It's led to the, you know, the total destruction of the olive harvest, for example, as a coordinated campaign by settlers to damage the Palestinian economy. And all of these things are happening with very little international attention. And again, this has got to end. There has to be a recognition of what is going on throughout the West Bank, of Israeli actions there, and how, and as we call when it comes to the situation in the Gaza Strip, there has to be international action to hold Israeli policymakers accountable for their decisions that have led to these horrific results.
Sarit Mihaili, we have to leave it there. We thank you so much for being with us with the Israeli Human Rights Group at Salam. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent campus community radio from Simon Fraser University. We broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coquitlam, Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh. We also stream online at cjsf.ca and listen to podcasts of our programs and our website.